Network.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
And I am so happy today because I have found a real Yellow Rose of Texas. And I am so thrilled that I have this wonderful author. And she gives me hope. I believe this woman is an amazing author and everybody should be reading this book. Her name is Cynthia Lil Macy. And Cynthia, I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper.
Patsy, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
You are amazing. You give me hope. I need to say that because I have gone through a lot of books lately that I was so disappointed with. And then one day, it was not a particularly Texas day here in the middle of summer, and it was a rainy day, and I picked up your book, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a miracle book. This book, which is called Of Deception, and it's a book inspired by true events and takes us back into the 1950s, and you have just brought the whole period to life. You are so incredible at painting a picture. Authors are always told, paint the picture. Cynthia, you have done it.
Well, Patsy, that is such a compliment. I work so hard on my writing, and of course, my background is in literature. I've been writing for 40 years now. It's been quite a while, and I've always liked to read books that paint pictures, that the landscape becomes part of the story, and that's what this was all about. The drought of the 1950s is the background for this story of deception, and of course, it involves the murder of a female turkey breeder. She was based on a real woman who was actually sniper shot as she was feeding her turkeys one March morning. And after she was shot, the suspect turned out to be her brother-in-law who lived on the farm next door. And he was gone. They could not find him. And so the story involves the search for him for over 4 years. And in those 4 years, in the present time, as the story progresses, the reader learns about the families, how this all happened, the background, starting from the Prohibition era all the way through the Depression of the 1930s, and then World War II, and then, of course, up to the drought, which was the catalyst for a lot of what happened.
And with this book, we have the reality of a murder. And we're now, you have just approached it from a wonderful angle. We're going to find out the why versus the who, why this happened. And the setting was there for you, but then you jumped into it and you brought it to life with these characters. We have characters who jump off the page, and in this case, Maggie Schneider, who was known as the poultry queen of Lippin County, which I had never heard of Lippin County, but there she was, the poultry queen. The whole idea of a breeder of turkeys, once I got into it, was exciting for me because having come from northern Michigan, where we actually, I've been around people who raise turkeys, so I know people are very special people. You have to be, because those things are not easy to raise. So you get into that, and then we have Amos Becker and Letta and Sam Schneider. Just when you came across this story, let's go back. How did you come across this story? You're a Texas historian. You've written other books about Texas. And then to realize that you've got this wonderful story to run with.
And that's, it's always about the story. And when a story compels you, you just can't, I couldn't let this story go. And what happened was, I was actually doing research for one of my other books. Now, this particular novel is my 10th book. And several years ago, I wrote a history of the town I live in. And I was walking around our old town district and interviewing old timers and that kind of thing. And so I was told to go to this country club that was in my town and to interview this man named Lester Kruger, who was the owner. And he had owned the bar since 1972. This was 2006 when I interviewed him. So he'd been around a long time. He came from a long line of pioneer families from our area from the 1850s. And so he was German and at one point had been a dairy farmer. Anyway, I walked into his bar and I told him who I was, that I was writing a book about the town and if he had any stories he'd like to tell me. And he says, I sure do. And he pointed to a rifle hanging on the wall of the bar. And he said, see that rifle? He said, it was involved in a murder. And I got it. I was related to the murderer. And I just said, okay. I said, well, that sounds interesting. Tell me about the story. So he pulls out a yellow sheet of old newspaper from the back of the bar. And it was the story of a few years later when they found the killer. And what was interesting was he was at the farm, the killer's farm, the day the killing happened. And he was also he was the one who found the killer 4 years later. So it was quite a coincidence. And in fact, he became one of the suspects during the real life search for this man and investigation. But obviously he was not the one who did it, but his story. So I got the story from him. And then I went to look at all the archives for newspaper articles. And there were several over the years, the 4 years that they couldn't find the killer. And so I originally was going to write the novel as nonfiction. I interviewed, like I normally do for all my books, I interviewed descendants. The thing is, both the killer and the victim, they were both married, but they did not have children. So there was no direct descendants of this family. There was peripheral people, cousins and uncles and aunts and stuff. So I tried to find people. Now, remember, this happened about, 70 years ago? So it was a long time ago. So a lot of people were deceased. I was able to, of course, Lester was one of the only ones still left who was intimately involved. And there was a few cousins. So I interviewed them, but I started realizing that I was not going to be able to write it as nonfiction because I didn't believe I had enough solid evidence for the things that I was hearing. I was hearing a lot of the personal stories and that kind of thing, and to the point where I said, you know what, I'm going to have to make this. I just couldn't let the story go because it was too fascinating and the characters were too fascinating, the real people. Their background histories I did a lot of research into, and they were, it was astounding in this one family that there were so many accidental deaths, suicides, very suspicious things going on in their families that were actually true, but I couldn't prove it. It's kind of hard to say. I decided this is the stuff that fiction is made out of, and so I decided to transform it into fiction. Now, I will say that all the characters' names have been changed, and even the reason you never heard of Lepon County is because Lepon County doesn't exist. I created that county. The towns are all fictional. So everything is fictional except for the storyline, the 4 years it took to find him and the investigation. The main characters who tell the story, of course, are Lita, the wife of the killer, Sam, who is the husband of the victim, and of course the sheriff, who is based on the real sheriff from that era who was in charge of the investigation.
What a story. Lots of people have stories about, I walked into a bar, but you have the ultimate story, the penultimate story. I walked into a bar. It's so beautiful. I'm telling you, This has to be a film. I want to start that film with you walking into the bar. I just,
yeah.
I can see this. I could write this. First of all, this is an amazing story. And somebody has to make this into a film, but I would do it from the perspective of you walking into the bar. This is like a dream.
Yeah.
An author couldn't make this up. If you made it up and you send it to a publisher and said, they say, oh, this it couldn't happen.
It's yeah, so that's true. Yeah, you're right. She walked into the bar. That way it all started then. And it's funny, the story grabbed me. It was such a fascinating story. And the more I found out about it, the more I said, and I have to tell you, I walked into that bar in 2008, and actually it was 2006 or 2000. It was early when I was researching this other book. The book didn't come out till last year, 2025, and to show you how long it took to percolate. And I started it, and then I put it down. I did a lot of research for about a year because, again, like I said, I was going to write it as nonfiction. And then I started working on other books. I actually wrote several other books in between this one that was in my mind, but this one would not let me go. I'm telling you, it was such an interesting story. And it's about these women, the woman Maggie Schneider. She was a real woman who, based on a real woman who was a turkey breeder and one of the first turkey breeders in Texas as a female in the 1950s. She was just a sassy woman. She carried a gun. She was very attractive. Men were attracted to her, but they also didn't like the fact that she was so independent. Remember, this is the 50s when women they stayed home and just cooked for their husbands, and very few of them did anything out of that. Now, a lot of them had gotten ideas that they could do stuff outside of marriage because of the war. She actually started driving the bus. She was a bus driver. So all those things that I have this woman doing, the real woman really did. And so she had all these people around her. The book starts out when she's deceased. You know all about her because there's so many flashbacks to the time when she was still alive. And because the reader needs to find out who this woman is and why somebody would have wanted to kill her, who turned out to be this man and Amos. And again, they pretty much know it's him from the beginning, but we all don't understand why. And so that was my big thing. That was what kept me writing. Why did this man do this?
And you manage to make, and it's always difficult when the person is dead and you have to build this story and build this arc and keep it exciting, that there's going to be a reveals along the way that of unexpected things that you discover about these people and about not just about the people, about the place, about the whole idea of a drought, which of course has its own drama built in, and people who haven't, and there's also the farming side. It's not easy, and certainly for Maggie, raising turkeys in Texas in a drought was not an easy thing. It's not like when I was a kid and we raised turkeys up north in northern Michigan where we had lots of water and everything was fine and dandy and they could go out and eat the grass. But in Texas, this was a real challenge.
Oh, it was terrible. That drought lasted 7 years. It was a long drought. And the other thing, too, that's a major part of the story and what got the sheriff, what his belief was and why this happened was there was three families and they shared the well, a big well, and it went deep into the Edwards Aquifer, but it was on Amos's property. He was in the middle, but so they had an easement agreement on both sides. On the other side, so we have Sam and Maggie living on one side. He's in the middle. And then on the other side, on the right side, is Otis and his family. And they have their own little issues going on. But they're all sharing the same well. So during the drought, the well kept going down and down. It never did empty out like some of the other ones did because it went real deep. But still, Amos was in charge of making sure that everybody used the right allotment. see. And so the sheriff immediately just went in there and said, oh, it's about the well. It's about water. And actually, there have been a lot of, in Texas over the years, and in that era especially, and earlier in the 19th century, about water rights. People would get killed over having the right head rights to a river or a creek. And so it's not so far-fetched that somebody would kill somebody else because of water. In this case, the reader has to realize, or the reader will see, that's not, that may have been one of the reasons, but it wasn't the major one.
But this whole, first of all, since I got to Texas, I have discovered that this whole water rights thing is serious. When you live in, coming from northern Michigan, we have Lake Superior. We don't worry about water. Or even, I lived most of my time in Florida, we didn't worry about water. We had very deep aquifers. But Texas, it's, even today, it is a strain. And in the old days when they had to find these wells and dig these wells, that was a whole incredible process what they went through.
And the thing, too, is digging a well, so we have limestone, it's rock. You're digging in rock, and it's not cheap. It's expensive. Today, then, at any time, it's very expensive to dig a well. And you're right, in Texas, and up to today, people are always trying to guard the water, the creeks, and that kind of thing. And the thing is, we have so many people coming to Texas now, and so many people, you put a house somewhere, and then or a subdivision, and they need water, it's a critical condition in Texas. It's not easy. So you're right, it's been going on for centuries, probably ever since people started coming here in the 19th century.
A lot of Western, of our favorite Western movies, were John Wayne was out there protecting farmers who were being killed for their water rights. So it's something that we've seen in films over the years. And so this is part of the story, what makes this so fascinating. Then, of course, the drought. And we're always talking about weather and weather changing. And the droughts that they had back in the 30s and then in the 50s, they changed the way of life.
They did. I have to mention something else is off the subject, but it's about another one of the characters that turned out to be one of my favorite characters, and that was the Larry Richter, the handyman. In fact, it was because of Harry. I realized when I was writing that I needed to find someone to tell some of the story that nobody else would have known, but the reader needed to know. And I realized that a handyman, and actually, I will say that Larry Richter is based on Lester, the man who told me the story. And so I thought, when people hire a handyman to come into their house to fix the plumbing or to do something, you generally just ignore them, and you go about your business talking to other people, and the handyman is there doing his business. But the handyman hears things. And so Larry hears all kinds of stuff from all the families, because he ends up being the handyman to everyone in the community, everyone out in the farming areas. He's basically a jack of all trades. He's a mechanic. He knows how to fix tractors. He helps out in the field. He knows a little bit about plumbing. So he gets called all the time to help out. So he has the privilege of hearing all these stories. So he becomes one of the characters telling his version of what he knew. And so I just wanted to mention that. He's one of my favorite characters.
He does, and he serves this very important purpose. First of all, your dialogue is amazing. When you're writing something based on history and it's also the period, you have to get a certain flavor in the dialogue. And you capture that. You make their dialogue flow so nicely. There's nothing stilted about this dialogue. This dialogue is fast and smart. And really, I know, of course, that you've written other books. But boy, this one, you pulled out all the stops here.
I really appreciate that. I actually have written a couple of scripts, so I've learned a lot about dialogue. I've always been, a lot of people tell me my books have really good dialogue, my novels, the dialogue. I like to listen to people talk, and of course, you know, in Texas, there's all these different kind of drawls and just accents that people have. And I listen to that, and I just, it just makes it so interesting. And so I listen to people, and I like to use that in my dialogue. And I believe that dialogue should, it should move the story along, but not tell too much, just enough to get the flavor of the character and what is happening. And so I do work on my dialogue because I want it to be like that. Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that,
well,
too.
It's really important. Why this book is, it's both easy to read and deep and layered. But just as an example, just last week I went to eat at the Cheesecake Factory. And the greeter there, a pretty young girl, she right away, she welcomed me very warmly. They always greet you in these restaurants nicely, but this was particularly sweet. I said, could I have this table? Yes, ma'am. I'm going to take you to this table. And if this is the table you want. And she's like, oh, she looked like she was 15, but she was probably 19. But she had this Texas warmth that you just don't get anywhere else.
No, that's true. I have to say, and Texans are very welcoming and warm people. Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. Of course, I'm prejudiced. I was born and raised in Texas, and so I've lived here pretty much all my life. My dad was in the military for a short time when I was quite young, but I was born here, and we came back when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old, and I've been here ever since, and I went to school here. I had to tell you a kind of a fun story. When I was, about being Texan, when I'd been in an organization called Women Riding the West for going on, 27 years, a long time, and we have conferences through all in the western states, in different states every year, Colorado, New Mexico, even Washington, and of course, in Texas several times, Oklahoma. Anyway, when I first started going to these conferences, there was a small group of Texas ladies. We would congregate together within our Texas roots. And one of the ladies told me from a different state, she says, I can always tell a Texan. She said, you ladies, first of all, you all wear makeup and fix your hair. I did notice that. We all like to dress up nice. We just like to dress up a little bit. And then she says, and then when someone asks, where are you from? All you have to do, all you say, you don't say I'm from a particular town in Texas. You say I'm from Texas. And everyone else says that they're from some town, like I'm from Wichita, Kansas, or I'm from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. They all have a specific town. But instead, they don't say, I'm from Colorado. They go, I'm from Denver. But in Texas, you don't say, I'm from Dallas, Texas. You say, I'm from Texas, and that's all you need to say. It's funny. I thought,
no,
yeah,
it
that's
is true.
True.
You do have this, well, you stand out. Again, just going into a store. Recently, I was in Chico's, and there were a bunch of women, all different ages, all different types. But boy, the Texas women, they stood out. You knew they were Texas women just by, they were, I think, a little friendlier to each other, to the people working behind the counter. They were all dressed nicely. They all had perfect makeup, and they were cheerful, as opposed to, there were a bunch of other women going around the store, and I noticed that they were all looking grim, not happy, not nothing. And the Texas women, you knew it immediately, and I felt, oh my gosh, I just wish I could look like these Texas women. Because
it is. It's, anywhere I go, I always can tell the Texans, and I gravitate toward them. And in fact, they do with me, too. Oh, you're from Texas? Oh, so am I. Okay. And then you're immediately friends.
Yeah, they are. And in the store, you could tell. They it's beautiful. And so you capture this dialogue. I started the show by saying, you give me hope. Because This is such good writing. This is such beautiful writing. And I hadn't read you before. I'm going to say I had not read you before. And now, of course, I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to read Fire Lilies, and I'm going to read the follow-up to Fire Lilies.
Caballeros of Ruby, Texas, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to read all of them. I'm going to read also Death of a Texas Ranger, which is a real true story, and this is one of your nonfiction books. And all of your books, I think you're on this level of being an award-winning author, and anything you've won, you deserve, and you should get something better and higher. And I keep what I can give you. I want eventually for you to be standing up there and accepting an Academy Award for best script from a book, because you are just so good. It's been a while since I felt so strongly that an author just, you take my breath away.
Oh gosh. You have no idea how wonderful this is to hear, because authors work by themselves. I'm in my office a lot alone, and you put out the best work you can, or I do. I work very hard on this. I don't use AI or any of that. This is me writing. This is the brain that God gave me that I'm using, and the talents and the education and all of the years of experience. And it's a labor of love. And I like I said, this is music to my ears that you're so complimentary of my writing, because, like I said, it's a lonely profession for the most part, but it's something most people, like, you're a writer, what does that mean? It just means that's what I do. It's not what I do, it's who I am. I'm a writer. I observe people. I want to tell the stories that resonate with people, that stay with them, that help them understand a little bit about who we are and why we are the way we are. So what you're telling me is just, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It makes me want to cry in a way, because I get emotional about this recently, because I do get so much bad writing. I do get, I get bad writing from great authors now. So many authors are not putting their all into it. And you have to put your all into it. You have to, when you're writing, you have to be in that moment. You have to be with those people. You have to be sitting there at the kitchen table, and you have to feel it. And then it comes across like you've accomplished here.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I've lived with these people for a long time, and I wanted to give them all justice, and even the killer, even the one who murdered her. It's not like a cut and dried situation. I'm not, and again, you have to read the story, and you did, so you understand what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that you have to sympathize with people, but you do need to understand that everyone has their, not the skeletons in the closet, but the things that they're trying to get through life, and the things that they take with them and that they can't change, that they wish they could have changed, but they couldn't. And so it's just about humanity. We all have these issues in our lives that control us, maybe not in a good way, sometimes in a good way, but it's just about humanity and all of the flaws that we have, but also the good things that we have. So that's what I wanted to portray.
Now, did you take yourself off to a turkey farm and get familiar with what it's like to raise a turkey?
What was a coincidence, and it may be not, because I don't really believe in coincidences. I believe in divine intervention. I actually contacted this woman who, and again, she's deceased. Thank God I was able to interview her. Her name was Teddy Jones, and Teddy Lee Stevens. She was a turkey farmer, but she was already retired when I interviewed her. And it turned out that her father had bought all of the turkey processing equipment from the husband of the woman who was killed.
Oh, my God.
So she had the actual equipment of all of the things that the woman used. And so she was the one. I went to her farm, and she showed me all the equipment. I took pictures of it. And then she explained to me how everything was done. And that's how come, if that part seems very realistic, it's because I got it from an actual turkey breeder.
Ah, that's why. That's why. Because did she have any turkeys?
She was no longer raising turkeys, no. But she said it was a very hard job, very time-consuming. And she had started when she was quite young, when she was in, is it the 4-H club?
Yeah.
She started raising turkeys then. But her father is the one who got her into it because he was a turkey breeder. And so she knew the whole story. But I was surprised. I didn't know when I went to her farm to interview her that her father had purchased all of this woman's, you know, equipment. So I said, oh, my gosh, this is the woman I'm writing about.
Oh, my goodness. But, so this is there's a Yiddish word for it. It's called beshert. It was meant to be. And this is beshert, that you, all of these little things that you walked into a bar. You walked into a shed. Like, it is so beautiful. It was just, we talk about the planets aligning themselves. Everything was perfect.
I agree. And even getting my publisher, Stony Creek Publishing, I really wanted to work with Lauren Steffi, who is the owner, the publisher. And he writes for Texas Monthly. He himself, on his own right, has written some wonderful books, nonfiction and fiction. And he's just a smart man. And he's a writer himself, so he knows writers. And I was so happy to get to be picked up by him. But he and his crew helped me quite a bit, especially on the ending. I had a really hard time with the ending of the book. And he's the one who says you need to step out of your little bubble, the safety bubble, and just write it. And I said, yeah, I guess you're right. I got great advice from him. And anyway, so even that turned out to be another divine intervention. I'm very pleased with the work that they do for authors.
Wow. So good. Now, of course, the Fire Lilies, which was it got an independent ebook award for best romance, right?
Best romance, and then it was a finalist for another award for best historical fiction.
And it's not easy. First of all, I was raised on Louis L'Amour's books when I was a kid. I read all of them because we had a it was a shack. We called it a camp along Misery Bay in northern Michigan. And it was where the guys would go fishing, both in the summer and in the winter, ice fishing. And so the reading material was mostly Louis L'Amour books. And as a kid, I just picked them up. I was very young. I was reading when I was 5 years old. And so I like anything west. I like Western stories. I like Texas books. I like cowboy books, which a lot of readers, if they've nowadays, of course, people aren't reading as much as they should anyway, but they're like hesitant to read it. But anybody, this book is for anybody. It's not a Texas book. It's not a Western book. It's just a human nature book. It's a story about humankind, people are, and all of the nuances that you put into this story. I just have to encourage people to read this. There's sometimes people get this negative thing about reading this kind of book or that kind of book. This book is a universal book in so many ways, because there are people like this in every society, in every country, and in all sorts of great classic books. We have the same story, but you just happen to tell it in a wonderful and very readable story.
I really appreciate that. Again, like I said, it percolated for 10 years, and I worked on it for 10 years going back and forth. And at one point I thought, oh, I'm not going to do this. And then I said, no, you got to do it. It's like the characters of the people who this happened to wanted me to tell the story. And I just So I said, okay, I'm going to finish it. I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do it. It was just that kind of a story. And you're right. And just recently, I got a finalist award from Western Writers of America, and they for the category of Best Western Contemporary Novel. And I thought it was a historical novel, but apparently that particular organization believes that anything before 1950 is so this took place in 1958. So they think anything after 1950 is contemporary. And I guess because people are still alive who would from that era, so I figured they to them it would be contemporary. I was 2 years old when this incident occurred, so I was alive. I wouldn't have known that it had happened because I was just 2 years old. But there's other literary awards that I've sent the book to that have not been announced yet that they considered it either historical fiction or mystery thriller or whatever. It's different things to different people. But I'm just very pleased that it was awarded, even the finalist award, because the Spurs have been around since the 1950s themselves. And so many wonderful writers have received awards from to be a Spur Award winner is just an honor. And so I being in the ranks of people like Louis L'Amour and Larry McMurtry, just Cormac McCarthy, there's just a lot of writers who have won either the award or gotten a finalist award. But even just to get a finalist award is quite an honor. And so I was very pleased with that.
You should get a lot more awards because I have not seen a lot of this kind of great writing. And the wonderful thing is, of course, as you say, you're a real human being. And so many people who want to write books, they'll say, how should I start writing a book? I don't know. I want to write a book. And first of all, I say, excuse me, do you read books? I'm telling you, it's amazing. I have so many people. I've been doing the radio program for over 11 years and now a YouTube channel, which you're going to be on soon. I'm going to have you on the YouTube channel. But so many people will say, oh, I want to write a book. And they've never read anything, of course. I assume that you've done some good reading in your past.
Oh, yeah. I've been reading since, like you said, you were quite young. I think I started looking at books when I was 2 or 3 years old and creating stories in my mind. And then by the time I learned how to read when I was about 6, I was like, oh, wait a minute. My stories are better than what's really the story that this person wrote.
Oh, I love you. I love you. Exactly how I felt. I was reading Perry Mason paperback books at the age of 5. So I know how you feel. But
yeah, I've been reading so much. But it's sad because today the kids are just so stuck on their cell phones and their computers and their iPads.
They have no idea what they're missing. They have no idea because once you get into a great book, your whole world changes. And I'm trying to get people to read more. But one of the things is with this book, I can't tell you how thrilled I am with it. And I always like to say, I will tell authors, it should be a film. Like the film is better than the book, but it's not. It's the exact opposite usually. The book is much better than the film. I mean, just take Wuthering Heights, for example. They just made an atrocious movie of it, which I wouldn't watch if you paid. You could not pay me. If you came along and said, I want you to watch this new film of Wuthering Heights, and I'll give you $5,000. And I need $5,000. I really do. But do I want to lose my mind, my memory, my love of Jane Eyre or Wuthering Heights so that I can look at some horrible actress ruining that image for me for the rest of my life? I'd say no. I don't want it. I don't want it. Yeah. I don't want it. I know in my heart, I know what Kathy looks like. I know what Jane looks like. I don't want to see it on film. But on the other hand, nowadays, sometimes the only way to get a book to really sell is for people to see the movie and then they'll read the book.
And they'll read which the book. Is, and that's true.
You know,
that's true.
People, yeah, they'll read the book. They, it's a mental thing. So, but, and of course, an author gets some reward out of it because if you're smart, because unfortunately, usually Hollywood screws the author of a book. I know it well. I was involved in, I was hired to write scripts for authors whose books they stole. When they paid them $10,000 or something, the poor author thought, oh, geez, I made $10,000 and they're paying me $25,000 to write the script. Duh.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Stupidity. So, yeah, it's poor authors. You guys have a rough time.
We do. But you know what? Early on when you first start writing, you have all these delusions of grandeur. Oh, this is going to be a bestseller on the right out the chute. And then you realize it's not like that. And then it can be very depressing. And if you're not a real writer, then you may even quit. You just say, I don't want to do this. Yeah. No one cares. But the main person that needs to care is the writer himself or herself. Yeah. And it's something, like I said, it's not what I do, it's what I am. And this, and I write.
Real
all
writers
the time.
Never quit. Real writers never
yeah,
quit.
No.
I am now going to, when people ask me, how do I start writing? How can I, what do I have to start doing? And they're all always ask me, what book should I get? What? Now, from now on, I'm going to say, here's what you do. You walk into a bar and ask them if they have any
stories to tell.
And if they say that if they don't have anything after the first shot of bourbon, well, I would take bourbon on ice, go to the next bar and keep doing that all night long until finally you hit a bar where the guy says, by the way, I have the rifle or I have the gun that was used in a killing. Now, there you can start writing.
Oh, yeah.
You think that's good advice I should give people? That's... Yeah, you do? Oh, I love you. I think you are amazing. Cynthia, you are amazing. So just tell people, I suppose you have social media and stuff you want people to go to.
Sure. They can visit my website. It's CynthiaLealMassey.com. I also have a presence on Amazon.com. Stony Creek Publishing has information about me on their website. Again, this is my 10th book. It's called Love Deception, and it's inspired by a true story. It's a murder mystery. And it's an award-winning book. A lot of my books are award-winning books, I'm pleased to say. So I do at least have that title. I may not be a best-selling author at this time, but I am definitely an award-winning author. And that's fine with me.
We have to do something about making you a best-selling author. I want to have you on my YouTube channel, and you'll come along and we'll chat there, and perhaps you can share some photos that you have. And I can...
Okay.
And I will share some real life turkey stories about turkeys that I have known. Oh, I love you. Anyway, everybody, really listen to me. This is not AI. This is a human written story by an incredible Yellow Rose of Texas, Cynthia Leal Massey, and of Deception. It's a great book. And thank you so much for joining me today. And I will be talking to you in a few days. I'll get you organized to be on the YouTube channel, okay?
Thank you so much, Patsy. I so appreciate it.
You are an incredible writer. Thank you again. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. What a book. I'm gonna start walking into bars. And what time is it in the morning? Big Ed, are you in the control room?
I am.
And it is 10:56. It's 11:56 for you. And somehow it should not appeal to me so much that I would like to walk into a bar and order a bourbon on ice at this time of the morning because I'm going crazy. But I always love to hear your voice. So you're going to take us out now. But how are you doing in general? Just say something nice to my
listeners?
I'm doing great. I'd do the bourbon too, but then I'd have to sleep the rest of the day.
I wish I could. Anyway, Big Ed, it's always nice to talk to you. Thank you for everything, and take us out of here. Bye-bye now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.